I'm Diane from Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, the Brentwood Al-Anon family groups in Nashville, Tennessee. Even though it says Brentwood, we're in Nashville. Wow, Montego. I've heard about Montego Roundup for several years. Never thought I'd actually be up here speaking, and been wanting to make it up here, so I'm really grateful to be here today. And boy, Jillian, thank you for your talk, and when I get into mine, you'll kind of understand why I say thank you. You healed a lot of stuff. Anyway, I'll go tell a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm from a very large family, 12 children in 12 and a half years. I'm a twin. There's 8 girls and 4 boys. And we are all very competitive. I think that comes from being in a large family, competing for, you know, attention and whatever. And being a twin also made me a little bit more competitive also. But growing up, I had all the wonderful things offered that children could have. My parents provided for us and sent us to nice schools, and I just was looking back, thinking about that today, and I thought, there aren't many people that got to experience what I did growing up, and I have no regrets about any of that, that I was, the way that I was brought up. Raised in a family, there wasn't a lot of alcohol abuse. There was alcohol. I don't remember ever seeing alcohol abused, except for parties and having fun. It was all about having fun and not a lot of drunkenness. And I had 2 grandfathers who probably could have qualified for this program, but they weren't around me very much. They were would stop in, and I just remember one grandfather always sitting around drinking beer, but he wasn't a problem, and the other grandfather was always having a great time. So I never really saw a problem with alcoholism really growing up, and when my parents would have parties, all their friends would come over, and they probably got a little high and stuff, but I don't remember it being a problem for anybody. I never remember that until I might have had some brothers and stuff and getting into trouble with a few instances with drugs and alcohol as a teenager. But for me, it was just, we would have wine or something like that growing up at special occasions. And that was not, you know, wasn't over excessive or anything like that. But when I got into high school, we ended up, I always wanted to go out with the boys that like to have fun. And when I look back over all that, if you weren't drinking or having a party or having fun, it was pretty boring. You know, it just, there wasn't a lot of fun involved. So I think I just related drinking and having fun. And we did that a lot. I had friends that in the neighborhood, when we would sneak off and have our little slumber parties, I'd have my 1 or 2 drinks, and my one sister would always get more. She would always be crying or throwing up or something. And I would look at her and say, gosh, I'm glad I didn't drink that much, you know, that I don't feel like she feels. And I remember that on several occasions, that kind of always made me keep a check on what I had to drink, that I didn't want to look like that when I'm out. And so I was always a control freak. I was a control drinker, you know. I don't remember getting drunk a lot. If I did, I probably just fell asleep, you know. Or I never really got sick because I didn't like that. And so alcohol was not, it was there. It was present. I didn't realize the impact that it really had on my life, that it was really important that we have fun, and that I was actually looking at those type of people growing up, you know, that was alcoholics. I can look back and see them coming in these rooms every now and then, that people I used to date, and I'd say, well, you know, that one made it, and I'm really glad, and there's probably a lot more out there that I dated that could probably qualify for these rooms. But growing up, I really had advantages that not many people did have. But I know I took in little things from growing up that made me the way I was when I walked into these rooms. I would date boys for a length of time. I identified some with Eugelian about I would date somebody until, you know, I got them, and then I'd go off and find somebody else. It was like I conquered that one, and I can date him for a while, and now what's the next challenge? And I saw a pattern in that for me, that I was doing that same thing. And I didn't know why I was doing it, you know. I would look back, and these boyfriends or something would write this real sob story, why are you doing? And I just didn't know. I mean, I didn't mean set out to hurt people. I just lost interest, I don't know what it was. But anyway, that's something that I got to look at in this program that I had done in the past. But I had a great time in high school. I did sports. I was in sorority. I learned to smoke. I went along with the peer group, you know. I would drink a little, but I smoked cigarettes, and I was just kind of following the crowd because I wanted to be liked. And I wasn't, even though I was part of most everything, I still didn't feel like I was, you know, that I had to try to do that. I still felt like I had to fit in and be a part of. And so high school was fun. I just kind of barely got by. I did not apply myself because I didn't see a need to. I thought as long as I can just get by, I'm okay. And I just got by, and my twin, I know, did not like the fact that I could just get by, and she would study and study and study. And so we fought like I think sisters do, and we were fraternal. We weren't identical, so there were a lot of opposites about us. But it was the competition growing up with her was, you know, I know that I had some resentment with. My mother would say, well, you can't go out unless Doris has a date and stuff. And I thought that was not fair, you know. She was looking out after her so that she didn't get her feelings hurt or whatever. But I remember those little things that I thought, well, I'll be glad when I can go to college and do my own thing. And oh, I also was raised in the Catholic schools for 12 years. So I had a lot of values and morals and things that were taught to me that I was really grateful for, that really helped me those first, you know, important 12 years of schooling. But as soon as I got out of that situation, I went to college, and it was like someone opened up the bird cage and let the bird out. Because I was afraid. I had a lot of fear growing up, that, you know, about going to hell and doing all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't do those things because I didn't want to do that. I really believed I was going to suffer the consequences later if I did some stuff. Well, when I went off to college, I really ended up stopping going to church, because then I didn't feel guilty. If I did things, I wouldn't have to kind of go and look and think about that. So I kind of dropped out of that. I was just set free. I had a lot of rules and curfews and stuff at home. And I don't blame my father for having those strict rules and curfews with 12 of us. And, you know, I'm sure he was probably more lenient than he should have been with us. But I thought it was a lot. So when I got away to college, it was like, it was in the 70s, the early 70s, and there was a lot of drugs and alcohol out there. And I decided to participate in a lot of them. And I was not comfortable doing that, but I did it. You know, if anybody offered me something, it was fine. I'd say, okay, sure, you know. And I was very blessed that I didn't get hurt or any, you know, have any severe consequences from that, other than after 2 years of college flunking out. But that, you know, I really didn't flunk out. I was on academic, whatever they call it, suspension. But when you have a 0.123, it doesn't really look real good on your records. And of course, I didn't want to look at that was a consequence either. And I had been dating this man who I had kind of really decided that maybe he is it, and I'm going to move back to Nashville, and this is a good way for me to move back to Nashville. And I had already figured out what I was going to tell my parents, on, you know, that my grades weren't good, that I would quit school so they didn't have to pay. You know, I made it look so good for them. They wouldn't have to pay for my education anymore. I'd come back to Nashville and I would start working and pay my own way. And really the whole thing was, is I wasn't doing anything in college and I did want to come home to Nashville. And it was just an excuse to come home, but it you know, made me look like a good person. and it was all about looking good. So I can look at that now and know that that was just part of my little manipulations that I learned to do. And I did. I came home and I started working after I'd been dating this man who ends up being my husband today. We had dated for a couple of years and it was a very fun time. There were a few things that were happening here and there that I ended up moving out of my parents' house at first because they started setting rules again on me that I couldn't do. I was like, no, I've had my freedom for 2 years. I'm going out on my own and I'm going to have my own. I'm an adult now. I'm, you know, 19 or so. I thought that was so old that I could, you know, take care of myself. And I did. I did. I got a job and I held a job and paid for an apartment and did just fine with that. And I was really, I said before that I believe I went to college for my MRS degree. I was in education as a side thing because I love working with children. And but I think I was really there because I'd grown up with a mother who was at home and raised the children. And even though she had a profession, she stayed home and worked. And that's what I decided I would do. You know, one day that was my dream, is to be a mom and stay home and raise the children. So I thought I'd found that with Mike when we were dating. And after about 2 years of dating, Mike broke up with me. And that's probably the first time a guy had probably broken up with me. You know, they stopped dating me or whatever, but this is one that I really cared about, that he broke up with me. And I totally did not understand it. Now, I think alcohol had already started playing a part in our relationship at that point. We had been having a lot of parties, you know, college age, and they're doing it today, and I can't say anything when my kids do it. We were doing it, and there were some instances that, things would happen, and I would say, that's not what that's all about. You know, I was in total denial about some things that were right in front of my face that I just didn't want to see. And Mike ended up breaking up with me. And so I wasn't going to let that bother me. I'll show him I'll be fine. You know, I cried the many tears and kept, you know, asking him, why? At least tell me why, you know. What's this all about? And he just said he couldn't tell me. He didn't know. He couldn't tell me. So that was really hard for me at first. But I decided, well, it's okay. I'll just go off and have a great time and do my thing. And I was living in an apartment with a sister and a friend. And this is the sister who I watched drink a lot. And and my roommate at the time did a lot too. And so I just kind of joined right in with them. We had lots of parties at our apartment. And I was, you know, started dating someone else. And it was a relationship that he was really cute and fun and everything. But we did a lot of fighting, which I'd never done before. I'd never seen that. I never witnessed that growing up. My parents never fought. They never had an argument. And I know that plays a lot in my relationship today. I can't have a fight. I don't know how to fight. I don't know how to argue. I don't like conflict at all because I never saw it. I saw it one time growing up with my mother. She finally got angry with my dad and threw something at him, and we just almost cheered her on. You know, we were so excited that she actually took a stand and did that. But that still, for me, I thought, they're going to go get a divorce, that's it, you know. I had never seen that. So that kind of conflict meant you were going to go off and run and get a divorce or something. I did not have a lot of good relationship skills growing up on a husband and wife. My dad was very controlling, and my mother just put up with it, you know, in my mind. And she was just busy taking care of us. You know, we didn't get to see a lot of the relationship and what a healthy relationship really was. I mean, they loved each other dearly and had 43 years of marriage when my mother passed away. But it was, I don't think I took the skills that I needed for a relationship at that point. So I really didn't know how to do that very well. And anyway, I was dating this guy, and Mike and I had been broken up for, I guess, about a year. And we were still being friends, and I had always and would make sure and invite him to my parties so he could see me having a great time with somebody else. And I would not even hardly pay any attention to him, just thinking, you know, he's just going to see what he's missing, you know. And he would be with his friends, and he wouldn't have a date or something, so that would even make it better. So I just kind of made myself available in that area to, you know, be the host and the party person and the happy person and not let it know, you know, what it was doing to me that we were apart. And after a year, Mike had gotten his wisdom teeth out, and he had called me, and under the influence of whatever it was that they gave him, he told me he wanted me back and he loved me and wanted to get back together, and, you know, because of drugs, we're back together today. So, you know, I know they play a part in everybody's life. They did for us. At this time, this guy that I was dating was actually, you know, living at my apartment with me. And when he asked me to come back, I said, well, you know, I've got this other boyfriend right here. And he was just kind of on truth serum or whatever it was and wanted me back. And I said, well, I'll just have to see. You know, I didn't really jump right back into that situation at first. And I went back and I was the only one in town. His family was gone, and he didn't know he was having all four wisdom teeth out, and he needed somebody to be there. And I had told the guy that I was dating at the time that I would be going and just taking his dinner to him that night. And he said, well, because he knew the scenario and everything, and he said, well, if you go, then I'm out the door. That's all it took for me. I thought, boy, that's the easiest breakup I've ever done, you know. It was like, okay, you've given me an ultimatum, and I told you I was going over just to fix dinner, and if that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. And I was out the door, and he was too. But he left his dog that was my favorite, so I got to have that dog for 15 years. He had given it to me, but he didn't take it back. So, but that started our relationship, and my mother, when Mike and I got back together after that year, he had asked me to move in with him. And I thought, well, you know, the 2 years that we dated didn't work. Maybe if I move in with him, maybe I'll see if this really will work. And so for me, it was kind of a little pre-trial, and everybody was doing that back then, and I did move in with him. And at one time, my mother had said, are you living? And I have a question to ask. And I said, what? And he said, are you living with Mike? And I said, yes. And at that point, she disowned me. She just couldn't face that. And I said, you know, I have to do this for myself. And if it doesn't work, then I know it's not going to work. I'm not going to jump into a marriage or anything if we can't live together. And, you know, it may be a mistake and it may be my mistake, but I need to make it. I can't just have you say that it won't work. And I believe that. I really, and I've learned that in this program. I have to experience my own mistakes. You can't really tell me. At least that works for me. I have to experience it and make that mistake for myself, and then I learn. But anyway, I did move in because he had said, my mom had said, you know, now he'll never marry you. He doesn't need that piece of paper. And I said, well, it might be true, but, you know, I've got to do this. Well, within 3 months, we were engaged. And, of course, I had to run home to mom and say, guess what? You know, we're engaged. You know, Mike went and asked my father, you know, for my hand. And my mother was all excited about that because she didn't think that she'd ever see that. And she was happy for us. And we got married like 3 months later and put my mother through a wedding that she had to plan in 3 months. I didn't know what it was, you know, but she had already planned my sister's, who was in July, and I was going to be married. So we just kind of doubled everything. Everything was a repeat of whatever my sister had. But anyway, we started on that wonderful marriage. I'd gotten my husband, and, you know, we were marrying, and I was still working. I was going to work, but within a couple of years, I decided it was probably time to start having kids, and I thought it was a joint decision, but I think Mike has said since it was not. But, I will say, well, let's have kids, and then I think that's a joint decision, you know. And I have learned I do that a lot. I think if he doesn't argue with me, then he's agreeing with me. So we had our first son, and we were doing a lot of partying. You know, we had our house. We had our friends, and of course our friends like to party along with us. And we were making, you know, he had a job, I had a job, we had plenty of money. We had this house, we had a boat, we just were living the great life. And I thought about 3 years later, it was time that we have another child. And at this point, we had our second son. And I think at that point, it may have been either right before he was born or after he was born, the partying got too, you know, a little bit too much. And I will say that my in-laws, we realized, would drink sometimes too much, and we'd get a phone call in late at night or something, and we'd hear stuff that was not particularly like them. They, you know, his mom would call us and say things that just she never would say. You know, she was the dearest, sweetest person in the whole wide world, and it took alcohol for her to say some things, I think. And so we realized that they drank a little bit too much, and at least I did. And I didn't think they were alcoholics, because alcoholics for me was the person on the side of the road that doesn't have a job, that's just a bum and doesn't have a family, and that's an alcoholic. You know, they just might drink a little bit too much. So when we were starting to party a lot, I decided that, you know, I had this responsibility of raising these boys, and Mike did too, and he was working really hard, and things were kind of starting to get a little bit stressful, I guess. And he was having to drink too. He was having such a stressful time at work, and then he started having depression and being treated for depression. And I thought, you know, maybe we're drinking too much. Maybe we're, you know, this is not a good example for these kids. And, you know, I would try to manipulate and guilt him into a lot of things, guilted him into going to church with me. You know, and I would do it by saying, you know, we need to set a good example for these children and be going to church. You know, and I was already doing that thing, you know, it was all to get him there, and thinking that would fix him because he was depressed. Maybe that would keep him from being depressed, or maybe it would keep him from, it would change his life, you know. And this time, my mother had developed cancer, lung cancer, and she was in Florida and was being treated for that. And the last maybe 3 months of her life, we moved her up to Nashville actually she moved into my house for 6 weeks, and then she moved into a guest house for the last 6 weeks. And at that point, I turned my focus off of him, put my focus on to the relationship with my mom, because we had developed a great relationship after and had done lots of trips together with my boys and stuff. And she had moved to Florida, and my father had retired to Florida, and they had moved there for 7 years. And when they brought my mom up to Nashville to be with us, I just kind of took the focus off of Mike and stuff, and just poured myself into being there with my mom. And I had two little boys that were very young, and like maybe 5 and 2 or something. And they would just, you know, be around, and they really don't remember that time much. But, you know, I took my focus, and I ended up really getting more involved into church. And I knew things just weren't right between Mike and I, but I didn't really know what it was. I just, you know, those old things that crept up and when we were dating were happening again, and some doubts and fears were popping into my head. And of course, I was just denying them all away. That's not the way it is. And when I would say something to Mike about, you know, he wasn't home on time for dinner or whatever, he would always do the, well, if I, you know, I wouldn't be working so hard if I wasn't trying to provide for this family, and, you know, I'm just doing it all for y'all. And by the end of the conversation, my confrontation with him was always me making an apology for even saying anything. So what I ended up doing was always, after several times of that, I finally learned not to say anything, you know, not to say anything. And especially with his depression and suicide thoughts, that I thought that I could actually push him over that edge. I did not want to be responsible for that. I thought maybe that was, that I could actually have something to do with that if I was not as good a wife, or if I complained, or I didn't do this or didn't do that. I was always a people pleaser anyway, so I really wanted to be a people pleaser in the marriage too, because I wanted the perfect marriage. And I didn't know how to confront. I didn't know how to argue. I couldn't handle that. I just couldn't get near that. That was not me. But I had never seen that, so I didn't know what was healthy, that you can actually disagree. So I dealt with my mother's situation and her death. And what I ended up doing for myself was pouring myself into church, you know, and I actually got a lot of relief there. I really did. I found a lot of comfort, and a lot of it was more meditation than anything. I found myself, I belonged to a church that was involved with hourly meditation kind of thing, sitting in a chapel like this. By yourself. And I just did that. I was signed up on a regular basis to go and sit and do that. And I just cherished that 1 hour of serenity. For me, it was an hour of serenity that I had, just a peace with me and my higher power. And I really got that from them. But after my mother's death, I really felt more moved to do that. I felt she was leading me toward that decision, and to get back into that, into spirituality that I'd really lost. And I know I'd lost that back when I stopped going to church, and I totally turned myself away from my higher power that I'd been brought up. That was really, I did enjoy and have a relationship with a higher power growing up. I do believe that my schooling did give me that. I do experience wonderful closeness with my higher power that I got at the earlier years, but drugs and alcohol just turned me totally away from that. It just was just a clock for me. It just turned it off. And when I started having my children, that's when I got back into, because I wanted to set that example for them and let them experience some of that too. That was important for me. It started, got back into that. Well, I went on, after about a year of after my mother passed away, I'd been hearing about this place called Medjugorje. And that's a place in what used to be Yugoslavia. And there was there were six young children. There were visionaries that had been seeing apparitions of Mary every day for, at that point, I think it was 7 or 8 years that they had been experiencing that. And someone had gotten me this information. Everything just kept coming to me, and I just thought, well, that's a place I need to go. And I went on a pilgrimage there, and I convinced Mike to go with me. And I thought, that's going to change our life. You know, that's going to be the thing that's, it's just this wonderful, powerful place, and he'll see the light, you know. And, you know, I had a very moving experience over there, and it was a wonderful thing, but Mike did not gain from it what I did. And it was hard for me thinking that, you know, he's missing all this, and I thought that would help our marriage and everything, and it didn't. And there was a lot of things when he'd have conflicts with his dad, and it would scare me, some of the things that he was saying in his depression. I would always try to fix it, you know. I always knew how to fix things. And I could tell you what you needed to do this and to do that. And, you know, Alan, I can't do that, but that was my thing. And I've got a reading today today's reading talks about that, and I'm going to, if I get time, I'll read that, because that was me. I wanted to fix everything, and I would always give him the answers of how he needed to deal with his dad and the situation at work and his mom and all those. I always thought I had the answers for him. And I never could figure out why we were having problems. You know, I would think we're just drinking too much, we're partying too much, you know. And so I would say, you know, to him, we need to stop drinking a little bit, because we might become like your parents. You know, I think they have a problem with, at 5:30 they like to drink, and I don't want to be like that. I don't want to make those phone calls late at night. I want to be the person I am before 5:30 every day. I don't want to be that other person. And so I would use that. I knew that was a type that would get him to stop. Or I would say, you know, we need to quit. It's Lent. Let's quit. And we'd always quit for Lent. Then my son came home. He was in fourth or fifth grade and studying alcohol. And came home and he said, Mom, you and Dad are doing drugs. And I went, what? Because we didn't let him see that. I mean, we were, but he didn't know it. You know. And I had stopped. I had stopped doing any drugs or anything. But I said, what do you mean we're doing drugs? And he said, well, I learned in school today that alcohol is a drug. And so when you drink, you are changing your feelings and stuff. You are medicating that. Or he didn't use those words, but whatever it was he'd used was a real eye-opener for me. And I thought, aha, something else I can use. So I went to Mike and I said, you know, Michael approached me today and said, we're doing drugs. And he brought up that alcohol is actually a drug, which I never had ever thought alcohol was a drug. You know, drugs are pills and liquids or whatever, dots, and just that's not drugs to me. But when he came up with that, I said, you know, we really need to stop. We don't want to impress upon this child that it's a drug and we're going to do it. So I quit, you know. It's just like I wouldn't drink anymore. And Mike said he would agree to that also. But then he came, he said, you know, it's just so stressful at work that, you know, he would just have a drink after work, but he wouldn't do it in front of children. You know, no, we had always gone to the bars with our kids, you know, for dinner. We'd always go to, we never went to Shoney's because they don't serve alcohol. You didn't go to McDonald's, they don't serve alcohol. We would go to the restaurants with the bars in them. And so they always saw us drinking, but it was just like one drink or two. They didn't always see us ever, that I know of. I mean, we could have been drunk, and they, I don't know, you know. But anyway, but when he said that, I thought, no more of this. You know, it's back to Shoney's and McDonald's for us, and no more drinking in the bars with them. And so Mike said he would just have one or two to take the stress off, you know, a little relieve that stress, because work was so hard. And he wouldn't do it in front of the children anymore. And then, so that got to, now I won't go into his story because he can tell you more about that. But things, you know, I thought were good for those few months that there was no alcohol. But really, he was miserable. He was just literally miserable. And it wasn't easy on me. I was walking on eggshells, you know. I was the person who, I would call him at work, if I could tell in his voice it was going to be a bad day, you know, my day would be bad in the morning, I could tell. If it was going to be stressful, I was stressed. I didn't know I could have a different day than he did. I just didn't ever know that. You know, it was like, it's going to be a bad day, I'll have a bad day too, you know, I don't want you to suffer alone. So, you know, I just did whatever he felt. You know, I didn't know I was doing that, but I did. I really did. I remember just the fear of not wanting to come home because I was afraid he was really depressed and, you know, I might find him committing suicide. And I didn't want to bring the children into that. So I did have that fear, and that was, and I'd kind of stuffed that away. That's one of those things that I had it, and then it's not happening, it's not there, you know. Everything's great, we're happy, and on the outside, we were always the perfect family. We looked perfect. The kids were at the right schools. I was starting, you know, things were going worse at work. Things were not going, money started getting worse. So we were starting to have to sell the boat or, you know, do some things. I ended up deciding I needed to get a job now. My youngest son had just started kindergarten. And so I thought, well, I can help with the money issues and start working. And things just started falling in place for me. And I got to work with children where I always wanted to work. And I was doing that on a part-time basis, and that was helping me a lot. And then that one time Mike came to me with something that scared me, and I knew it was nothing I could fix. And finally, you know, I remember going to church and just praying, and I remember surrendering Mike to God one time. I was at that chapel by myself, and I just said, God, I've tried everything. I don't know what's wrong, you know. Hopefully you can fix whatever it is, and you know what it is, and I'm just giving up. I'm not going to try to get him to church anymore. I'm giving up. And I didn't know what I was doing, and God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself in that situation. And I did. When I did that, then the situation came that I finally said, Mike, you need to get professional help. I don't know what to do. This is something beyond my control. Nothing was ever beyond my control, but, you know, because I had this father and this family, and we could fix and do anything, and I just never thought I would say those words, and I did, and he proceeded to get help, and it ended up sending him to a treatment center, and when they told me that, you know, we had a meeting with the thing, and I said, what do I need to do, you know, like, how do I fix this, and he told me, he said, pack his bags, and I was like, what? And he said, he needs to go to treatment. And, of course, he couldn't do that. But he'll tell more about that. But in the treatment center, they did a family week. And in that family week, I had my children, who were 8 and 12 at the time. And I got to find out what that wonderful word, enabling, was. God, that was so hard to hear. You know, I kept saying I was just being helpful, you know. And when I came into these rooms, somebody said, you know, helpfulness is the sunny side of control. I thought that was a compliment, and I wrote it in my book. I thought, oh, isn't that nice? Sunny side, that's great. Until I got awakened to really realize, I laugh at that now. Because I needed to look at that, because I was always very helpful. And I can be very helpful today, too. And I have to, when people say I'm helpful, I just kind of have to look at that. And when I found out I had to detach, and I was like, how do I detach? The two slogans that were what really stuck with me the very beginning in Al-Anon was to keep my mouth shut. That's not in print, but it needs to be. And the other one was to mind my own business. And those two things, I just had to bite my tongue. Mike would come to me and ask me questions and stuff, and I'd just look at him and smile, and it's like, I don't know. And he finally just said, I hate this detachment thing. He just could not stand it that I wasn't doing it. But it was so funny, because what I learned that is when he asked me those questions, and I would give him the answers, if they didn't work, it was my fault. And if it worked, you know, then it was okay too. But, you know, that way there was no responsibility on his part if I gave him the answers. So I felt like I was having to do the same thing with my kids. You know, it's like today, you know, whose responsibility is it? Do I need to be solving it for them, or do they need to figure it out? You know, it's the same thing I need to do. I needed to learn to make mistakes. I could only learn from my own mistakes. My mom and dad could tell me all the things that were right and wrong, but I just had to experience them for myself. And then they really hit home. You know, I just can't go by word alone. You know, actions are speak so much louder than words for me today that, you know, I have to experience things, and I have to experience pain. And early on in the program, I got to experience the biggest pain of my life, besides losing my mom. There was a situation that we had gotten into the program, and I had decided to go to Al-Anon, because I'd signed a little piece of paper, and they gave me my One Day at a Time book, and I went and I started going to meetings. And at first, I just went in the first meeting. They told me how sick they were, and they talked about how sick they were. And I just thought, I don't need to be here if they're sick, you know. How can I get better if they're sick? And I didn't understand. And so I found what today is my home group. I found two different home groups, actually, because one was an Alateen group, and they had an Al-Anon meeting. And I asked my children to go to those four meetings and make a decision, because I knew that alcohol had affected their lives. And they had gone to that one Alateen meeting that was in Nashville, and they came out of that meeting saying, Mom, if you choose not to go back, we still are. You know, they had found a home. So, Alateen really, I know Alateen is not always the best. That's where my kids told me they learned to smoke and drink. That, but they found a home with people just like them. That they could talk to, and they could say anything to. You know, they could talk about alcohol at their house. And at school, they couldn't do that. You know, and it's the same for me. I found my home in Al-Anon, because at work I couldn't tell people what was going on at home, you know, because they would judge. I work at a school that's a Christian school, and I knew if I said some of the things that were going on, that they'd all judge and say, you know, you've got to leave him. There's no way. Why are you staying with him? You know, and I felt somebody understood me in those meetings. Excuse me. And I'm so grateful that I did, because if I had taken other people's advice and left, I would not have what I have today. And when I came into that meeting, I'll tell you the situation with my boys. I was the disciplinarian in the family, and I was always telling them how they had to act, what they had to do, you know, and everything, because I was afraid that they would be too loud or whatever, and they couldn't play and have fun all the time. You know, they did a great job, but I was, you know, they needed to do their homework. I was just on them about everything, every move they ever had to make. So as a result, I did not have a relationship with my kids. I would hug them, and they would not hug me back. And I really didn't know how to hug when I came into these rooms. And I remember those first few hugs, like Juanita talked about, those real hugs. I remember getting the first few hugs in my Al-Anon meeting when they won't let you go. And really feeling somebody really meant it. It was not just lip service or anything. And they were really glad that I was there. And I thought, you know, I never really felt someone. I had to make myself important enough to be somewhere, but I didn't have to do that in Al-Anon. And so I started going to Al-Anon, and I would start hearing, I remember hearing somebody else share one time about the fear of their husband committing suicide, and you know, it just really hit home for me. I thought, gosh, I had that fear, and I had never dealt with it. I had never, you know, I had to stuff, I always stuffed my feelings, and they would always come out sideways. They'd always come out the wrong way. My kids would spill their milk or spill something or drop something, and I would yell at them. You know, all my anger came out to them because I couldn't get angry with Mike. I couldn't get angry with other people because you might not like me or you might divorce me, you know? And I was so insecure that I did not think I was, that I could make it on my own. I had to be in this marriage and I had to do anything to make it work. And that's the way I also believed in my religion that said, you know, you stay married for life, you don't divorce. And we had gotten into this program, and some things, Mike, one night, I finally confronted some of my fears and said something to Mike, and he was honest with me. And it was, I got an honest answer for the first time, and I don't regret asking that question because for me, it put me in the pain I needed to be in to want this program. You know, I was in this program at first because I thought it was going to help keep him sober and it was going to make my family perfect. And I didn't know it was all about me. I just didn't know it was all about me. And, you know, I had some questions and some doubts and some things I asked him, and he came clean with me on it. And that just sent me into a place that the pain, I didn't know what to do but come to y'all. You know, come and be able to share with somebody who shared in a meeting about it, you know. And I grabbed that person, somebody shared in a meeting, and I grabbed that person and I said, you know, how did you do it? You know, you're still with your husband. How did you do this? How did you make this marriage work? And she told me she was in Al-Anon and that she had to work through that. And I poured myself into Al-Anon. I ended up eventually, you know, it took me a long time to get a sponsor because I was looking for somebody just like me. Why? I don't know. You know, don't look for somebody just like you because, you know, you don't want somebody like you. Usually you want somebody that can look at you and see the differences and stuff. But I got a wonderful sponsor who loved me through the first few years, and then our schedules didn't work, and I finally decided it was time for me to get a little bit rougher sponsor. somebody that was really going to say, you know, not just be loving to me and say, you know, that's BS or whatever, you know, you're not, you know, don't tell me this, this is what you need to do, da, 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 da. And I needed somebody to really get on me and to be, and so I asked a good friend of mine who is no longer in this program, but she was a great sponsor for a while too, and she walked this program with me, and I ended up doing many four steps different ways, and I had to do each one the way that it was done, and I ended up working this program to the best of my ability and really finding out how I can live and stay in this marriage and be a good mom. And I had to go through a tough, you know, I had two teenage boys within the first three or four years. They started going through teenage years, and that's never easy. I think I had Mike was doing his AA program, which was wonderful, and I needed the Al-Anon program for my teenage, to deal with my teenage boys. I was having them call me, you know, I'd get the call from school, he's been kicked out, we found drugs, you know, you gotta come get him. And I was like, you know, not my baby, you know, but it was my baby. And the older one had always been able to, he really poured himself into Alatine, and whether he learned the good tricks or whatever, he never got caught. And he just was doing, you know, just rebellious things anyway. But my youngest son, we were having some problems with, and I had a really hard time trying to get him into another school after he'd gotten kicked out of the public school system. And he was in eighth grade, and I kept going to different schools, and they all kept saying they're not going to, you know, take him in the middle of the year in a graduating class. You'll just have to do this, the Boys and Girls Club, which is the Alternative Learning Center. But I was still waiting for a phone call from them, and I wasn't getting a phone call from them. And so I had some many God experiences. You know, I finally, my sponsor, I was fed up. I said, what am I going to do with this child? My sister's just taking care of him because I've got to work, and he's got to be in school. And she said, just, you know, just give it. You have to pray and trust. And I said, okay, I'm giving to God till Friday. You know? If I don't hear anything Friday, I've got to do something. I can't go any further. This is going to be a month. That's my deadline. And, you know, Thursday night I got that phone call from the school, and they said, you know, we've got an appointment with you tomorrow. So I had to call my sponsor and said, God called, you know. I got my call. And it was not what I thought he needed to be doing, but I trusted. I had to trust that that's what God had out there for me. It was so funny because I'd put that on him, and we did. He got to spend a year in that school system, and it was the best thing that ever happened for him. It was exactly what he needed, not what I thought he needed. And so those are some of those little things that I started getting, those God things that I kept having to trust. You know, it's not what I thought was always the best thing for my child. And I thought, well, now he'll never get into trouble again. Well, you know, of course that didn't happen. He was 18 and he was a junior. He just graduated. I mean, he was getting ready to go into senior years, and he was 18. He said, Mom, I think I'm going to move out of the house. And Al-Anon gave me enough strength to say, okay, that's what you got to do. And everybody was going, how can you do that? How can you, you know, I couldn't even tell people at work, you know, they would have thought I was crazy. But I had to trust that, you know, I said, you know, he's 18. If he makes it, great. If he doesn't, great. You know, he's got to fall either flat on his face or he's going to make it. And either way, he's going to learn something from it. And I got to watch him, and 6 months later we got we were actually at the Huntsville Roundup. God gave us the Huntsville Roundup, 4 days of speakers and serenity and stuff. And I came home, and he and my older son are sitting in my living room, and we're like, what are y'all doing? And he said, well, we've got to tell you something. So we got to sit down and get the call that, you know, he'd gotten arrested Thursday night with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor. And I thought, you know, being in Al-Anon and them being in Alatine, he wouldn't have to do that. But that again, it needed to happen. It needed to happen. And Al-Anon was there for us, and AA was there for us. And we got to sit back and say, you got to do it. And we got to say, this is yours, honey. You know, whatever happens, happens. You know, we don't want you to go to jail. We don't. But you're going to go find your lawyer, and you're going to find, you know, and you're going to pay for it. And, you know, we love you. We love you. We don't hate you for what you, your choice. But it was one of those things that I knew God, it was in God's hands, and everything turned out fine. He did. He got to walk through that and go through and do some stuff and probation. And the minute that probation was up, he, you know, hightailed it to California. He decided to be better in California. And, you know, but today we have a great relationship. I let him do his thing, you know. I'm not controlling his life. And he said, Mom, that was the best thing. You know, we talk about it today. And he says, you know, getting arrested that time finally woke me up. It finally woke me up. And scared me enough that, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. So So he chooses to do some other things, you know. But, you know, I know he's on back God's path. I know he's got a journey that, you know, God put me on a journey. You know, I didn't find this until I was 40. You know, I'm so grateful. And I just have to keep trusting that these God things happening. When Mike and I have been through that, and Mike's had some things he'll tell you about. One, we had a really hard year, the year of 2000. My son called me and asked me how I felt about being a grandmom, and I said, I can't wait, but I can wait, you know. And I didn't really have a choice. It was I was going to be a grandmother in August, and they had already been engaged. And I said, well, do y'all want to move the wedding up? And they said, why? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. It just kind of crossed my mind. You might want to move it up. And they said, no. We think we might even move it further. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, I got to say, okay. I didn't have to say I'm disowning you. I didn't have to say that unconditional love stuff. I got to say the unconditional love. And I told them, I said, you know, whatever your choice is, I support you. And your dad and I are there. We love you. I had such fear. I lived in such fear about that. I thought, you know, they don't have insurance. They don't have this. She had insurance. It was just going to be running out. And they moved to Nashville, and my son quit college and got a job because we said, this is yours. You know, you can do it. And we'll support you in anything, not monetary, not money-wise, but we'll be there for you and help you if you need it. And we love you. You know, I learned how to say I love my kids and really mean it, regardless of what they were doing. You know, when I got that disownment from my mom that said she didn't love me, you know, that told me she, and I know she did, but my message was, you know, she didn't love me because I wasn't doing what she thought was best for me. And what happened was I have two boys, and they gave me a granddaughter. And she is the joy of my life, and I get to do girly things with her. She's 5 years old now, and I'm her Didi. And when she, you know, is asked what she wants to do or who she wants to be with, she wants to be with Didi, you know. But it's because I get to work this program with her, you know. I get to do Al-Anon stuff with her. I don't get sucked in. I don't have to do the things that I did with my children when they were little. You know, I get to love her unconditionally, too. And we have such a great relationship. My son and daughter-in-law, they did get married. And my granddaughter got to be the flower girl in the wedding and go down barefoot, just so cute, and got jumped up on stage. When they turned around to say Mr. and Mrs., she jumped up there because she thought they were clapping for her. And, you know, I got to experience those wonderful things that I know, had I not been in this program, I probably wouldn't be speaking with them today, or they wouldn't be speaking to me because of my controlling and thinking they needed to do what I think is best for them. So I really have to learn, you know, this program has really learned, helped me to keep my mouth shut, you know. I can think one thing, but I don't have to say it, you know. I've been able to just sit back and watch it, and, you know, all these God things happen. All the fear. I look back at all my fears that I've had for my children, for my grandchild, for my relationship, for my marriage. And I look back, and if I were to tell you how many of those things actually happened, it would be actually zero. None of those things ever happened. And so today when I go into fear, the first thing I think about is none of my fears ever happen. I'm not going there, you know. Someone said at a speaker meeting at Music City, and I just loved it, the future is not the past. You know, because it happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen in the future. And I've been able to sponsor some people in this program that I get to see that. And being a sponsor, to me, really helps me learn how to be a sponsee. It's interesting how that works, but, you know, my sponsees will call me with something, and I know I'll end up saying something that I need to hear, that I really need to hear myself. It's something I need to get back in my head that I'm not doing or I haven't thought of lately, but they're kind of bringing it to the surface for me. So I know, and being, they're open and honest with me, and they tell me everything. And I know that that's the way I can be with my sponsor because they trust me enough with their stuff that I can do the same thing. It's been a real learning thing being a sponsor, and how to be a sponsee, because I'm not always the best sponsee, you know, or the best. You know, I don't pick up the phone enough. I just think I don't want to bother her, but you know, I know that's not true now because my sponsees have called me, and I know it's not bothering me. And if it is, I can tell them that I'm not available at that time. So it gives me the courage to make those hard phone calls sometimes. And if I can't pick up the phone and get to them, if I really need to talk to somebody, I can call somebody else. The relationship that I have, Mike and I walked through our problems that we had in our wedding, I mean in our marriage. It took many years. It took a lot of years. It took a lot of work. It took a lot of trust. And we had to build back a lot of trust in our marriage. And I've gotten to see how this program, if I focus on myself and just work my program and let him work his program, we come together. And if you would think we would go apart, but you know, we end up, the more that I work and do my program and keep the focus on me, our relationship gets better. And I know that's all because I'm taking the focus off of him and where it needs to be, putting it onto me and working on finding all of my stuff that's going on. I know I don't have much time, but I do want to say that we have a wonderful pamphlet in Al-Anon. It's When I Got Busy, I Got Better. And for me, that's, if I look back and say, why am I doing better and why are we doing good? It's because that we've gotten busy in Al-Anon and AA. I was talking to somebody last night and I was telling her what I do as far as I've got my home groups, and I go to meetings on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and on Mondays I meet with my Al-Anon friends and we have a step study. And sometimes we'll go to roundups, and on Sundays I've got a church commitment, and I'm busy. I'm busy. I do service work. I work in the AFS office. I do things that I'm committed to my groups. I've heard too many times in this thing, you know, get committed and you'll stay here. You know, get a commitment that keeps you staying. I got to watch my sponsor, my second sponsor, get better and decide she wasn't going to go to Al-Anon anymore. And, I just knew that was, you know, what she needed to do for herself. And I trusted I would find the new sponsor I needed. And each sponsor has been different for me. And this new sponsor has gotten me involved in some other stuff. And she encouraged me to do these talks and gives me the courage to do them because that's what she does. And I've got my sister situation now is my relationship with my sister and all my sisters and my brothers. We have a great, great relationship. I'm able to talk to any of them at any time. You know, I used to have a lot of competition with them. I don't do that anymore. My dad had many strokes and died a couple of years ago. And I got to have a relationship with him that I don't think any of the other brothers and sisters ever got to have. Because I learned in Al-Anon how to be a daughter and on an equal level with my dad and not be that, not let him take control of my life and be the, you know, the people pleaser and stuff with my dad. I got to actually have a great relationship with him. My brother, who I did not have a really close relationship to, and I was probably the one that I considered, there were some things in our growing up years that I had some resentments about and some things with him that I didn't like him. I just considered him the black sheep of my family. And I was just sharing this the other day that I got, this is one of those God things I wanted to share, that I was home a couple of weekends ago and Mike had gone out of town and my dog had been escaping. He's an escape artist. And I couldn't figure out where he was escaping from, and I finally found, one of my neighbors helped me find where he was getting out, and we were getting ready to take this trip, and I had to get this fixed, my fence fixed, before I could take my trip, and I thought, well, Mike told me where the chicken wire was and the stuff, and I thought, okay, I'll go do this and try to do this, but it's going to be hard to do on myself, on my own, And as I'm getting that stuff, in pops my brother from Montgomery, the one that I don't have this relationship with. And I've done lots and lots of prayer, you know, the praying for him. And the resentment disappeared, and I would catch myself talking to him on the phone and actually saying, you know, at the end of the conversation, I love you, and I'd hang up and I'd go, who said that? You know, I've never told my brother I loved him. You know, just that's not what I did, not with that brother. And he popped in from Montgomery, and he's so mechanical, and so he does that type of stuff. And I found myself saying, is it, you're just the person I need. You know, God just put him there. He took and did that chicken wire and fixed it for me. And I was like, this is the brother that I, you know, really didn't care for and stuff. And he really just dropped everything and did this thing for me and stayed and visited and then left. And I was just like, you know, I didn't even think about that till I was up here and got to share about that. That's one of those little God things for me, that what can really happen and how God mends families and mends marriages and men's relationships, because I don't have any resentments today. I don't have any bad relationships today. I can be around my family of origin and use these tools. I had to be around a family last, my daughter-in-law and son, and I got to be experience some new addictions that I've never seen before. And they were so loud, and they were right in my face, and boy, I just couldn't wait to get to a meeting, you know. I actually opened my mouth one time and said something, and the next day I made an amends for it, because I thought, that's your life, that's your choice, that's not my business. But I had that obsession of the mind was just going nonstop, and I couldn't deal with it. And, you know, I was out of town, and I ran to a meeting, and it was just what I needed. I came home, and I got with my sponsor, and we got to talk about it, and share, and what got me finally out of that obsession, I finally realized, was I got into gratitude about that relationship. And it's an addiction that doesn't hurt other people except for themselves. And I thought, you know, it could be worse. It could be drugs or alcohol, and it could be, you know, killing somebody and really affecting somebody else. But it's something brand new for me. But, you know, I got to get into gratitude and got out of that obsession of the mind, and I got to my meetings and worked with sponsees, and they've just been calling like crazy lately. And I know it's because it's what I need. You know, it's really what I need, not so much what they need, but it's what I needed to get my mind off of the other stuff. And I know I'm just about running out of time. I want to thank everybody here for being here. I want to thank everybody. Thursday night was so wonderful and special. Yesterday morning, the meditation group with you wonderful women, thank you for including me. That was great. I feel like y'all are all my new family. And I did want to just close with today's reading and Courage to Change, because I felt like it really said a lot. For years, I lamented the absence of a label that would identify the soul sickness that brought me to the fellowship. I wanted to say, I'm a recovering controller, enabler, caretaker, fixer. Although they identify some of my character defects, these labels miss the mark. I'm not simply seeking recovery from one limitation or problem. The goal I'm striving for in Al-Anon is an overall sense of wellness. My pursuit of this goal began by seeking recovery from the way a loved one's alcoholism has affected my life. But today, Al-Anon offers me even more. As I heal and grow, I find that it's no place longer than simply to survive. The principles and tools that brought me this far can help me to create an increasingly rich and fulfilling life. Today, when I say I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, I'm not zeroing in on one particular problem, but rather participating in a whole host of solutions that can lead to emotional, physical, and spiritual health. And as a result, this program has given me a closer relationship with my higher power, a closer relationship with my family, friends, and just everyone in general. And this is my family. When I walk in these rooms, I feel I'm at home. Thanks.